Good morning, and welcome to a very special Terry Saul Show, the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. On today's show, we are going to take a look back at the events that happened in Dallas, Texas, 55 years ago, the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. We are going to talk with retired police detective James Lavelle. He was the police officer that was handcuffed to Lee Harvey Oswald when they walked through the Dallas jail that Sunday morning and Jack Ruby lunged forward and ended Oswald's life. We will hear from KSLM's Doc Nelson and Dan Sheets, who will reflect their thoughts as this all unfolded. So join us for a very special Terry Saul Show, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. November 22nd, 1963. It was a warm, sunny day in Dallas. As a matter of fact, the forecasters had predicted cooler weather, so Jackie Kennedy ended up wearing a Chanel wool suit. She would wear that suit until the wee hours of the morning of November 23rd. President John F. Kennedy had come to Dallas to do a bit of pre-election fence mending. Conservative Governor John Connally and the more liberal Senator Ralph Yarborough were at odds. Surely Kennedy's charm would smooth this over. After a stop in Fort Worth, they took a short plane ride on Air Force One to Love Field in Dallas. The motorcade was to follow a winding 11-mile route through downtown Dallas, where President Kennedy was to speak at a luncheon with civic and business leaders at the Trade Mart. At 11:50 a.m., the motorcade left the airport. The big presidential limousine, a midnight blue 1961 Lincoln, had been flown in from Washington, D.C. The plastic bubble top was removed, and the bulletproof side windows were rolled down because the weather was so nice and favorable. This is how President Kennedy preferred to ride. The Secret Service 1955 Cadillac convertible followed closely behind the president's limousine. It carried 8 agents, with 4 posted on running boards to quickly dismount the car and protect the president from the crowds. The president and Mrs. Kennedy were in the back seat, while Texas Governor and Mrs. John Connally were in the jump seats up front. The motorcade arrived in Dealey Plaza and then made a right turn from Main to Houston Street, and just seconds later, it made a 120-degree turn onto Elm Street, passing by the Texas School Book Depository Building. The crowds were larger than expected and very enthusiastic about the young president and his pretty wife. At 12:30 p.m. Central Standard Time, a shot rang out. Kennedy's hands began to rise as he starts to turn towards his wife. His expression changed from a smile to astonishment. Connally recognized the sound as a gunshot and begins turning to the right. Riding in the front car, Secret Service Agent Roy Kellerman says to the driver, Agent William Greer, "Let's get out of here." But the reaction was slow. The limo was moving at about 11 miles an hour, leaving the president in the sniper's sights. Jackie Kennedy crawled onto the trunk of the limo. Agent Clinton Hill managed to get onto the trunk and shove her back into the car, placing his body over hers and the president's. ABC News interrupted their regular programming.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special bulletin from ABC Radio. Here is a special bulletin from Dallas, Texas. 3 shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade today in downtown Dallas, Texas. This is ABC Radio. To repeat, in Dallas, Texas, 3 shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade today. The president now making a 2-day speaking tour of Texas. We're going to stand by for more details on the incident in Dallas. Stay tuned to your ABC station for further details. Now we return you to your regular program.
In the car of the Vice President, Lyndon Johnson, Secret Service Agent Rufus Youngblood sensed the danger and yelled, "Get down!" He would hop from the front seat and shove the Vice President towards Mrs. Johnson, covering the Vice President with his body as his duty required. Back in the president's car, Agent Kellerman yells, "We are hit!" In the follow-up car, Agent Hickey searches for a target but finds none, while Agent Clint Hill springs from the running board on the car behind and moves towards the president. The limo now speeds up to 80 miles an hour in a race to Parkland Hospital, which is about 4 miles away. At Parkland, chaos ensued. Agents surround Lyndon Johnson over his protests. They hustle him inside to protect him. Mrs. Kennedy, bent over her husband, refused to allow him to be removed. She protected his lifeless body from view with her own. Sensing this, Agent Hill removed his suit jacket and placed it over the president's head. Mrs. Kennedy turned to Agent Hill and said, "You know he's dead. Leave us alone." Mrs. Connolly is annoyed that everyone is fussing over what she knows is a dead man while her injured husband is in the front seat being ignored. Finally, Connolly is taken inside the hospital, as is Kennedy, still with Agent Hill's coat over his head, his wife holding on to him. Upon arrival at 12:37 p.m., Kennedy still had a faint heartbeat, which quickly extinguished. A doctor enlarged the bullet wound to perform a tracheotomy. If it had been any other patient, they would have most likely pronounced him dead, but they had to try to revive the mortally wounded young president. Back to ABC News.
We interrupt this program for another bulletin from ABC Radio. Here is a bulletin from ABC Radio. More on the shots fired at President Kennedy's motorcade today in downtown Dallas. No casualties have been reported in the first bulletin. However, there is a later bulletin that says there is perhaps a serious injury. The incident occurred near the county sheriff's office on Main Street, just east of an underpass leading toward the trademark where the president was to make an address.
Don, let's stand by. Let's keep all the nets on the all the stations on the line. We feel that we have an important news bulletin here, and there are details coming in. All stations, stand by. It is believed now that Don, you better read this.
All right, right. Ladies and gentlemen, to add to this bulletin from Dallas, Texas, there is a possibility that the president, Mr. John F. Kennedy, has been seriously wounded. Now, we ask your attention to stand by on this bulletin. We ask your attention to stand by on this bulletin. Stand by on this bulletin from Dallas, Texas. Here is some more information that is just coming in. This is from the Associated Press. It says President Kennedy was shot today just as his motorcade left downtown Dallas. Mrs. Kennedy jumped up and grabbed Mr. Kennedy. She cried, "Oh, no." The motorcade then sped on. Now, that's the bulletin that is just received by ABC in New York from Dallas. Word from the Associated Press that the president, Mr. Kennedy, was shot in the motorcade in Dallas, and that Mrs. Kennedy jumped up, grabbed her husband, and cried, "Oh, no." The motorcade then sped on. The incident occurred right near the county sheriff's office on Main Street, near an underpass leading toward the trademark where Mr. Kennedy was to have made an appearance. And from the United Press, President Kennedy and Governor John Connolly of Texas were cut down by an assassin's bullets, as they toured downtown Dallas. They were traveling in an open automobile. Now, the UPI story, United Press International, says that both President Kennedy and Texas Governor John Connolly were hit by the bullets today in Dallas. An Associated Press photographer, James Altkin, says that he saw blood on the president's head. Altkin said that he heard two shots but thought someone was shooting fireworks until he saw the blood on the president. The AP photographer said that he saw no one with a gun at that moment.
All right, Don.
Now, Nick George, New York editor for ABC.
Don, just an advisory. We're staying on the air as long as we need to. We have our reporter in Dallas, Bob Clark. He was immediately behind the president's automobile. We have Bob Clark on the telephone. We will switch immediately to Bob Clark, ABC in Dallas.
And critically wounded, perhaps fatally, by an assassin's bullet. Three shots were fired at the president's motorcade as it passed out of the downtown area of Dallas. The Secret Service immediately gave orders for the procession to speed out of the crowd and took the president directly to Parkland Memorial Hospital. I am at the hospital now. The president was taken in a few minutes ago, lifted from the car, placed on a stretcher. He was motionless. The first lady leaned over him, crying. Lyndon Johnson also appears to have been struck by one of the bullets, though he was able to walk into the hospital. Governor Connolly of Texas was also wounded. It's uncertain at this moment how seriously. There is no word yet from the surgical room of the hospital as to Mr. Kennedy's condition.
That's a late report from Bob Clark, the ABC correspondent in Dallas. Here's a late report from United Press International. It says that the president, his limp body cradled in the arms of his wife, rushed into Parkland Hospital. The governor of Texas, John Connally, also taken to Parkland. And Clint Hill, a Secret Service agent assigned to Mrs. Kennedy, said, and I quote, "He is dead." That is what Clint Hill, a Secret Service agent assigned to Mrs. Kennedy, said today. He is dead.
Back at Parkland Hospital, agents were suggesting to Lyndon Johnson that he begin thinking about leaving Dallas and being sworn in as the president. At this point, a conspiracy to kill them all was a real possibility. Johnson was less aware of Kennedy's condition. Back in Washington, Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy, the president's brother, received the news at home in Virginia from FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. Meanwhile, Senator Edward Kennedy was in his office in the Senate. Back at Parkland, Mrs. Kennedy returned to the hallway, and a nurse asked her if she wanted to wash up. Her response, "No, I want them to see what they have done." She would repeat this several times to several people throughout the day.
You've been listening to ABC's correspondent Bob Clark reporting from Dallas, Texas. Let me repeat that we have only this word. It is not an official word, but a Secret Service agent who was assigned to Mrs. Kennedy, his name is Clint Hill, said to Mrs. Kennedy, "He is dead." This is a report from United Press International. That is the only word we have on the state of the president at this very moment, other than the fact that he definitely is injured. He was taken to Parkland Medical Center in Dallas, Texas. In addition, Vice President Johnson, as Bob Clark just reported, he walked into the hospital. He was holding an arm as though he appeared to have been injured too. Texas Governor John Connally also was injured as the assassin's bullets tore into the president's bubble-top limousine in Dallas today. Apparently, there were several shots fired, as Bob Clark reported. He heard three shots. He was traveling in the motorcade, just a couple of cars behind the president's limousine as they went through downtown Dallas. Mrs. Kennedy, as the action occurred, jumped up in the limousine, grabbed her husband, and then cried, "Oh no." The Secret Service immediately gave word for the motorcade to pick up speed and head immediately to the Parkland Hospital in Dallas.
Up until this point, there had been a delay to release much of the information to the public. Perhaps it was as simple as no one wanted to say the words. All the public knew was that President Kennedy had been shot. No details, but an announcement had to be made. Mrs. Kennedy wanted the time of death placed after he received the sacraments, and the doctor Malcolm Perry agreed to this. It was now 1 p.m., and so it was fixed as the time. CBS's Walter Cronkite was the first to make the announcement.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time. 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago. Vice President Lyndon Johnson has left the hospital in Dallas, but we do not know to where he has proceeded. Presumably, he will be taking the oath of office shortly and become the 36th President of the United States.
Debate ensued as to an exit plan. Security was an issue as the nature of the assassination was unclear. Also, Lyndon Johnson did not want to leave without Jackie Kennedy, who would not leave without her husband. In spite of Secret Service pressure to get them safely to Air Force One, Johnson said, "I will not leave without the President and Mrs. Kennedy." As a compromise, it was decided Johnson could wait for the Kennedys on board Air Force One, and so he was evacuated from Parkland Hospital. You're listening to a very special Terry Saul Show, the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas, Texas, 55 years ago. We will be back with more, including our interview with Police Detective James Lavelle, Doc Nelson, and Dan Sheets. All of this and more on Salem's original radio station, 104.3 FM and 1220 AM KSLM.
Anybody here seen my old friend John? Can you tell me where he's gone? He freed a lot of people, but it seemed the good they died.
You're listening to a very special Terry Saul Show, the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas, Texas, 55 years ago. We now continue with our report. On November 22, 1963, President John F. Kennedy was shot and killed in Dallas, Texas. Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested for the crime. Oswald was at work at the Texas School Book Depository and was seen with a package which contained, he said, curtain rods. At lunchtime, most of the employees rushed outside to catch a glimpse of President Kennedy's motorcade, but not Lee Harvey Oswald. At the time the president passed by, no employee other than Oswald was on the sixth floor. William L. Brennan was 107 feet away from the depository, saw three employees on the fifth floor, and a youngish man on the sixth floor with a rifle. He saw the rifle retreat from the view after the shots were fired. Brennan later gave a description to police as a white male, around 30, slender build, height 5 feet 10 inches, and weighed about 165 pounds. Around 12:40 p.m., Oswald boarded a bus. He then rode the bus for a while and then hailed a taxi cab. After exiting the taxi cab, Lee Harvey Oswald was wandering around the streets with no plan in mind. Officer J.D. Tippett was slowly patrolling the neighborhood. Oswald, loosely fitting the assassin's description, so Officer Tippett rolled down the window and began a conversation. Whatever was said, it did not satisfy Officer Tippett, so he got out of his patrol car. Watching him from across the hood, Oswald allowed the officer to take two steps, then pulled out a revolver from his pants and fired five times rapidly. His aim was deadly. Officer J.D. Tippett was dead within seconds. Approximately 1:15 p.m. As Oswald began running, he was dropping empty shells and reloading new ones. Oswald decided to sneak into the Texas Theater, about 8 blocks from where Officer Tippett was shot. He was seen by Johnny Brewer, who works at Hardy's Shoe Store across the street. Brewer had noticed Oswald acting suspiciously, especially as patrol cars passed by looking for their man. Brewer got the theater's employees to contact the authorities. The police quickly converged on the Texas Theater. Oswald punched Officer Nick McDonald while grabbing the Smith & Wesson. The officers pounded upon Oswald, frantically trying to get the gun away from the cop killer. Oswald was punched, possibly after he was handcuffed. He screams police brutality. Later, he tells police officials that he may have had it coming since he did punch Officer McDonald. At 7 p.m., Oswald was arraigned before Judge David Johnston for the murder of J.T. Tippett. And later, at 1:35 a.m., early on the 23rd, he was arraigned for the murder of John F. Kennedy. On Sunday, November 24th, as the nation remained stunned by the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, Lee Harvey Oswald was to be transferred to custody of the sheriff at the county jail. Dallas police were aware that Oswald was widely hated. They knew he was a target, all of which makes what happened impossible to understand. Oswald is being transferred to the county jail and will pick up the ride in the Dallas police garage. We all watched the coverage live on TV. Lee Harvey Oswald was shot. America was astonished. Oswald was handcuffed to police detective James Lavelle, and he never had a chance. A few years ago, I had the opportunity to interview retired detective James Lavelle. Here is his interview in its entirety.
Jim, how you doing?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
You're down there in, what, Garland, Texas? Is that where I understand?
Yeah, Garland, Texas. It's a suburb of Dallas.
Well, if we could, let's go back. You were working for the Dallas Police Department. How long have you been working for the Dallas Police Department?
I was a little over 13 years at the time.
Okay. Now, the morning the president was shot, how did you find out he was shot? What were your thoughts?
My entire bureau, the Homicide and Robbery Bureau, was assigned to the motorcade, except for myself. My partner was on vacation. And my captain told me to just stick around the office and take care of anything that came in. In the meantime, I had information where a robbery suspect was holed up that I had a warrant on, so I went out along with a patrolman they assigned to me and arrested him and come back in. And we was listening to the motorcade police radio as we came in, and then we parked into the basement of the city hall where Oswald was later shot. The motorcade was approaching Houston Street, which is right in the area where the assassination occurred. So when we turned the radio off and got out of the car and went went through the basement, caught the elevator up to the third floor. The shooting of the president occurred during the time that I was traveling from my car to the third floor office.
So you got out of your car and the president was okay. By the time you got to your office, he had been shot.
Correct.
Now, at that point, what was going through your mind?
Of course, my first thoughts was who and why and so forth. You have an awful lot of thoughts along those lines. And two, you wondered if how much was involved in it, whether there was more than one person involved and so forth. Of course, the conspiracy people caught later on really went into that, but
sure.
When we started working the homicide, why we did it on the assumption that there might be a conspiracy. We didn't have any other alternative but to look at it from that standpoint.
Okay, after the president... I'm sorry.
As it turned out, it wasn't.
All right, after the president was shot, were you assigned to the case, or, I mean, how did you get involved?
That's kind of a long story, you know. A lot of people don't understand it, but my lieutenant told me to put my prisoner up in right away and get down to the Gilman Houston Street and find out what was going on. You see, back in those days, we didn't have all these radios and two ways and all that kind of stuff that they got today.
Mm-hmm.
So if we wanted to talk to somebody in the field, they had to get on find them a pay phone somewhere and call in. A lot of people don't realize that this day and time, but that's the way things were back then.
Mm-hmm.
So he asked me to go down there and see what was going on and call him and inform him so he would know what was happening. And so that's what I attempted to do. Charlie Brown, who I was working with, proceeded down there, but we couldn't. We lacked about two or three blocks getting to the intersection because of the traffic, so we had to park and walk the rest of the way. On our arrival, while the inspector of police that was on the building, front of the building, when I asked him if the building had been covered off, meaning nobody could get in and out, he said that it had been, and that my people, talking, referring to the homicide officers, was already upstairs. And then he told me that he had sent some witnesses over to the sheriff's office, and so knowing how witnesses have a way of changing their stories after a period of time, I thought best that I get over and check on them and see what they had. So this is what I did. I went over there, and we ended up with some officers that was available to take their statements. There's about 15 or 18 people there. So when I got them strung out taking those statements from the witnesses, I was going to go back to the book depository, but about that time is when the shooting came in on Officer J.D. Tippett.
Mm-hmm.
So I picked up the phone and called my lieutenant and asked him who was covering the officer shooting, because to me that's as important as the president, but that's part of the family.
You bet.
He said, I don't have anybody to cover it, so I said, well, I'll take it. Knowing I couldn't get to my car, I borrowed a car from one of the other officers that managed to get his car down there, and I went to the scene of the officer's killing, and of course, Officer J.D. Tippett's murder was assigned to me, and I spent more of my time that weekend making a case on Oswald for that than I did working on the presidential thing.
More with Detective James LaBelle when we come back. You're listening to a very special Terry Saul show, the assassination of President John F. Kennedy 55 years ago. We now continue with 98-year-old retired Dallas Police Detective James LaBelle.
What led you to Lee Harvey Oswald then?
When Tippett stopped him over there, and then just a routine stop, it wasn't anything. I'm sure Tippett had stopped him. He had a general description of what the shooter looked like, and he saw Oswald. I had three eyewitnesses who saw all of this, saw him walking down the street at a pretty good clip, so he just pulled over and called him over to the car, and I'm sure, of course, Tippett was never able to tell us because he was dead, but I'm sure what he asked him was where he lived and if he had identification and so forth, and when Oswald probably answered yes, J.D. got out of the car, according to the witness, and very casually started walking around the car, and when he got to the left front fender, Oswald stepped back from the car and reached under his shirt and pulled out that .38 pistol and shot him four times. He was dead when he hit the ground. He never knew who he stopped. But all of those witnesses were, I later had them identify him in a police lineup with other people who were similar to him in size and age, and they were able to pick him out without any problem.
Now, once Oswald was picked up in the theater there, now let's move a little forward. He's in custody now. Did you have a chance to interview him and speak with him?
Well, when I was called and told that they had the suspect arrested in the theater, and I attempted to go to the theater, but traffic again was such that I couldn't get there, so I told the radio, the dispatcher, to radio the people that had him in custody at the theater, take him to my office, and I would meet him there. So that's what happened, and they got to the office before I did, and when I arrived at the office, he was sitting in what we call an interrogation room. It's just a small room with a desk and a couple of chairs where you can sit and talk to somebody without being interrupted by telephones and so forth.
Was he talkative? Was he quiet? What was his demeanor like?
He was very calm and collected as far as I was concerned. I talked to him some 15 minutes, but see, during this whole time, I was talking to him strictly about the shooting that was offered J.D. Tippit. I didn't have a clue that he was going to be a suspect in the presidential shooting. So all of my conversation with him at that time was about the murder of Officer J.D. Tippit, which he denied, of course.
Mm-hmm.
As I told him, I said, one of the things I told him while I was talking to him, I said, Lee, you strike me as a pretty smart individual. I said, you know that we can take the pistol that you had on you when you were arrested and fire ballistic test through it, match it to the bullets found in the officer, and prove that it came from your gun. He said, well, I know that, but you'll just have to do it. In other words, we may convict him, but he wasn't going to help us do it.
Exactly. How do you feel sitting in this room with this man who just shot your governor, who allegedly shot the president of the United States, and more importantly, like you said, shot a fellow police officer? And now you're sitting in this room with this. I mean, didn't you just want to reach across there and just strangle the guy?
Well, no. You can't afford to do that. You might, thoughts like that may go through your mind once in a while, but you can't afford to do that. I've been in police work for too many years and had worked too many. This was the third police officer murder that I had worked, so it was not something brand new for me, and from experience, what you have to do. So you have to be, if you lose your cool, then you're lost. You can't interrogate
somebody.
You've
lost the game, yeah.
So I just kept it calm and collected and tried to find out from him what I could. Of course, he denied. He answered all my questions very readily. He didn't answer them truthfully, but he didn't seem excited or anything. He was much calmer, I would say, under the circumstances than I could have been had I been in his position.
Sure. Was he placed under a suicide watch at all?
More or less. Anytime he was in his cell, we put him in an isolated area. We have three cells up on the fifth floor that are isolated from the other cells, and there was no one in those cells, so we put him in the middle cell of the three. And then any time that he was in that cell, we had a uniformed officer sitting in a chair just outside his cell to observe him. So you could say, in essence, that we did have a suicide watch on him. We didn't want him to hurt himself, or we certainly didn't want anybody else coming around there talking with him either.
Right. All right, now it's time to move Oswald from the Dallas Police Department to the county jail. How was the decision made that you would be handcuffed to Oswald?
The only way I can answer that for you with is that Captain Fritz and myself have been working pretty close together on this situation since, as I said, I was assigned to police officer's murder, and of course he was spending most of his time with the presidential murder. So we were working pretty close, hand in hand, with this thing. And when the time come for us to transfer him, the cap just told me to handcuff my left hand to his right, and then also put a set of cuffs on him so that his wrist would be handcuffed together in front of him.
Did you say anything to him before you left?
I did say something to him, but I said it in jest or more than anything else.
What was that?
I told him, I said, Lee, if anybody shoots at you, I hope they're as good a shot as you are, meaning, of course, that they'd hit him and not me. And he kind of laughed. He said, well, nobody's going to be shooting at me. I said, well, if they do, you know what to do, don't you? And he said, well, Captain Fritz has told me to follow you, so I'll do whatever you do. I said, well, in that case, you'll be on the ground in a hurry. But that happened much quicker than I expected.
Yeah. Now, as you came into the garage, when did you see Jack Ruby?
I saw Jack as I stepped out into that basement there, just a fraction before he actually made his move to shoot Oswald.
So
he was standing in the front of that group of reporters. He had the pistol in his hand and was holding it against his right side. And I saw that out of the corner of my eye as I was looking towards the automobile that was trying to back into position to pick us up. And the reason it hadn't gotten into position was because the news media crowd had kind of crowded in, and the car was literally pushing some of them with the bumper. So I saw him out of the corner of my eye, and I jerked back on Oswald to pull him behind me. And as Ruby made his move, and he took two short steps and double actioned at 38 into the middle of Oswald. So, but being right close to Oswald, I couldn't get him out of the way. All I did was turn his body so that the bullet hit him about 3 to 4 inches to the left of the navel rather than hitting him dead center.
Did you think at all that you may have been in the line of fire at the same time?
Well, if the bullet traveled through Oslo and went through his stomach. He cut the vena cava, it went through the liver and took a chunk out of that. It cut another main artery, and it hit the left, the seventh rib on the right-hand side. And if it had not hit that rib and bounced off and lodged under the skin, it would come on through and hit me in my left side. Mm-hmm. But the rib stopped it from coming all the way through and hitting me.
So he Jack Ruby only shot him one time. He was trying to shoot him multiple times, but he only got one shot off. Is that right?
That's correct, because Mr. Graves, the detective on the other side, grabbed the pistol in such a manner that it wouldn't fire. You know, a lot of people are not familiar with it, but he was using the revolver, and if you can stop that cylinder from turning, well, it won't fire. And so I saw all this all took place in you might say 2 seconds time. I could see that Graves had caught the pistol in such a manner that it wouldn't fire, and I had reached over and caught a hold of Ruby by his left shoulder and shoved back and down on him. But when I saw that Mr. Graves had that pistol in such a manner that he wouldn't fire, Oswald crumpled to the floor right away and became unconscious. And one of the other detectives helped me pick him up and carry him back into the jail office where we laid him down. And I took the handcuffs off of him. And, of course, the ambulance had been summoned, and it was there within about 2 minutes. And
so with one hand, you're pushing Jack Ruby back, and your other hand, you're still handcuffed to Lee Oswald.
Correct.
Okay, so now Oswald's shot, and he falls to the ground. You're still handcuffed to him. The question that a lot of our listeners, why was Jack Ruby there? Why was he allowed in a secured area like the police garage? You guys knew Jack Ruby. How did he get in there?
That's kind of a long story, but I'll give you a quick version of it. He wasn't permitted in there, but the shooting in the basement clock by our police radio was at 11:21 that morning. At 11:17, Jack Ruby was a block away from the city hall, sending a MoneyGram to one of his girls over in Fort Worth. We later got the copy of that MoneyGram, and it was dated and date and time stamped at 11:17. Now, that's only 4 minutes away. So 4 minutes from the time he was shot, he was down there sending his MoneyGram. And, well, I transferred Ruby the next day, but I didn't tell the news media that I was going to do it.
Right.
I asked Ruby how he got into the basement, and he told me that after he sent this MoneyGram, he decided he'd walk up and look down the entrance ramp for the police basement to see if he could see what was going on. He said, I knew they wouldn't let me in there. But he said, I thought I'd look down. And he said, just as I walked up through that ramp, a Lieutenant Pierce with a sergeant in a marked squad car drove out. And we only had one officer over there on that side. There was another mistake that our department made. We should have had more than one officer there, I guess. But there wasn't nobody over there. Now, on the exit side, we had over 100 people waiting to see us come out with Oswald.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody was over there on that entrance side. As Ruby walked up there, he said Lieutenant Pierce came out, and the lone officer turned his back and walked out into the street to hold up traffic so he could make a left turn. And he said when that officer turned his back to walk out there, he said, I just darted behind the car and got down and mixed with the news media and worked myself to the front. Well, I later went through the same procedure that he did about that MoneyGram. I had him to go through the same procedure, and when they gave the time, I started clocking it, and I finished up, got my change, walked out in the street, and up to that ramp. It took almost 3 minutes, roughly 3 minutes to do that. So he could not have been in that basement more than a minute or a half a minute before I got down there. So that's where that 4 minutes comes in.
Did he plan on shooting Oswald, or was he just walking by, saw the opportunity?
It just worked out that he was able to, I don't know what you call that situation, but something's happened. A lot of coincidence there, and he walked up and he had the opportunity and he took advantage of it.
Okay.
Well, he had thought about shooting Oswald before.
Did he ever say why he shot Oswald?
Yeah, I asked him that too, and he told me, he said, I just want, when I transfer him, I asked him why. I told him he didn't do us any favor, and he said, Lavelle, all I want to do is be a hero, and it looks like I've just fouled things up good. That little insight to that was, I got to thinking years earlier when I was still in the uniform patrol, and he had a big dance hall down the south end of Dallas, and we used to go in there in the evenings and see if there's anybody had too much boxing glove whiskey in them and they wanted to fight, and we'd take them and send them home.
Sure.
We seldom ever put anybody in jail. We'd just tell them, oh, you've had enough to drink, you ought to go home and get rid of them. And while I was talking to him one night in there, this was 13 years earlier, he told me, he said, you know, I always wanted to see two police officers in a death struggle, and I could jump in there and save them and be a hero. Well, I thought about what he told me what he did there that morning when I transferred him. I got to thinking about what he told me 13 years earlier. So he was telling me the truth. All he wanted to do was be a hero.
Anybody here seen my old friend Abraham?
Back in the ambulance, now you rode with Oswald to the Parkland Memorial Hospital, and this is that same hospital where just 2 days earlier the president had been pronounced dead. Was he conscious at all? Did he say anything?
No, he lapsed into unconsciousness right after he shot. And of course, see, that bullet struck a lot of the vital organs in him. Actually, with those blood vena cava and blood main arteries he'd hit, he actually bled to death. Would be the really the cause of death. I don't remember what they put on the autopsy report, but with those two arteries cut, he more than likely bled to death.
Did you know that?
On the way to the hospital, he groaned one time and moved his hands. I was holding on to one of his arms trying to get a pulse rate, which I wasn't able to do. He moved and groaned, and then he went completely limp, and I've always thought maybe that's when he expired.
So you knew on the way to the hospital that you were going to lose him probably then?
Yes, I did.
Okay. In the trauma room at the hospital, you asked a nurse for the bullet. Is that what I understand?
Yes, of course, when I examined him down in the jail office, I saw where that bullet, that it just lodged right under the skin, and I could roll it around with my fingertips just right under the skin. So when I got him in the trauma room out there, I told the doctor, I said, before you do anything else, I want this bullet out of him. So he just turned him over and pinched it up and hit it with a scaffold, and it just popped out like a ripe grape seed into a little tray that the nurse was holding. And so I immediately had her scratch her initials in the butt end of that, and telling her that, I said, you and I will be testifying that this bullet is the one that came out of it, because I knew that later on I'd have to tie that bullet to his death along with Ruby's pistol.
So at this point now, you're alleged suspect in the shooting of the president, the wounding of the governor, the shooting of a police officer. He's now shot. He's now dead. What are you thinking now?
Well, the first thing, I think we're in a heck of a mess, because we lost, there's a lot of information that we could have gained had he lived. And on top of that, we would have been able to convict him without any trouble. As it turned out, we didn't have the evidence right then when he was shot, but I kept on working on it. I worked on it off and on for 2 or 3 years, and got evidence together where we could approve beyond a shadow of doubt that he did this and done it alone. But since we didn't get to go to court on it, we weren't able to show all of this.
Okay, so then the following day, which is about the 25th of November, you needed to escort Ruby from the holding cell to the garage to the trip to the county jail. Was he in fear of his life at all?
Yes, he was. Yes, he was. And on the elevator, when I brought him down, he wanted me to let him wear my hat or my coat and all of that so people wouldn't recognize him. I said, Jack, ain't nobody going to shoot you in the first place. You ain't worth killing anyhow. So I said, nobody's going to be shooting at you. But I didn't handcuff myself to him either. But when I got him down in the jail office there, and I had made arrangements for the car to come through, and I had an officer standing outside watching for it, and he was just to nod his head as soon as the car drove in, and there would be nothing said. And so I just promised Ruby to go, and he run off and left, and he got to the car about 10 feet ahead of me and crawled into the back seat and hunkered down on the floor behind the back seat. I crawled in there and put my feet on him, and that's the way he went to the county jail.
Jim, what is your theory? Do you think Oswald acted alone? Do you think Ruby acted alone? I mean, you've had 41 years.
I know that he did. Of course, like I said, we had a lot of time to work on it. If I had 2 or 3 hours here, I could explain it all to you, but I don't. Just to answer your question, there was no conspiracy. Oswald and Ruby did not know each other.
How have the events 41 years ago, how have they affected or changed your life?
Well, I think more than anything else, I didn't realize it, but instant recognition, I guess, on the street by strangers was one of the biggest things that changed it. And I still have that happen to me today. And I was out in a restaurant just 2 weeks ago, and a lady and her husband come up and asked me if I wasn't Jim Lavelle and one that handcuffed Oswald. So we recognize you. And of course, they seem to think it's an honor to meet me and shake my hand and so forth. I try to tell them I'm not a celebrity or anything. I'm just an old retired policeman just doing my job.
It's been 41 years, but you still receive letters every week and requests for interviews. Matter of fact, you're doing a few radio interviews this week. You still, after 41 years.
Well, this is the second one I've done this week.
Okay. And after 41 years, you still receive letters. And you answer every one. one of those letters, don't you?
Yes, I do. I answer all of them, and like I said, I'll average about 3 a week over a period of a year.
I understand that the former police department building is going to be open to the public to view the garage area.
That's what they're contemplating doing, and they're going to tear down some of the building there that's probably not in use right now, not connected with the city hall area, but make a little park area out there across the street from it. I've been interviewed by ABC and CBS and so about that, and they're asking me the same question what I think about it, and I tell them that over the years I get many, many inquiries that comes in through these letters that we're talking about. How can they get down to the basement and see where Oswald was shot, and how can they get upstairs to see the cell where he was held? A lot of interest is in that, and I think that if they'll open it up and make it accessible to the public, that it will be just as popular as the so-called grassy knoll is down there where the president was shot.
Do you go by that area often, the Texas School Book
Depository? No, not very often. Every time the museum down there has anything, they send me a notice to come down and be a part of it, but I don't, I seldom ever go down there.
Okay.
My suit and hat and tie and my handcuffs and stuff like that I had on at that time, they're on display at the 6th floor museum right now.
And you've never been up there to that museum?
Oh, yeah, I've been up there. I haven't been up there since I let them have the suit, and that's been over a year and a half ago to display, and I was up there that when they put it on display, but I haven't been back since then.
The photograph that obviously you know which one I'm talking about, the one where Jack Ruby is shooting Lee Oswald. Yeah, I mean, that photograph has been seen literally around the world. Do you feel you are a part of history?
Well, it's not a question of feeling it. I'm sure that I am. At least my picture is. A lot of people don't know who I am, but that picture certainly is a part of history, and I've been told by people that have done research on it and so forth that it is the most publicized picture that has ever been produced.
Jack Ruby was 52 years old. He claimed that he killed Lee Harvey Oswald to spare Jackie Kennedy having to come to Dallas and testify. He called Oswald a creep. Although he had showboat attorney Melvin Belli, Jack Ruby was found guilty of murder on March 14, 1964. He was sentenced to death. He appealed and won a retrial on the basis that procedural errors had occurred during the trial. Jack Ruby, however, never got his retrial as he died in 1967 of cancer. Where did he die? Parkland Hospital. I was in the second grade, Mrs. Schulte's class at Bookson Elementary School in San Jose, California. I remember that they canceled the 10 o'clock recess because it was raining outside. So during the 11 o'clock recess, they let us go out and play for a while. And I remember coming back in after the recess to an empty classroom. The teacher wasn't there, and we were all just kind of sitting around waiting for Mrs. Schulte to show back up. After a few minutes, Mrs. Schulte came back into the class crying, and I couldn't believe it. My teacher, an adult, was crying. What was that all about? At that point, she told us the President of the United States had been shot and that we were all to go down to the cafeteria and assemble down there. Upon arriving at the cafeteria, our principal, Mrs. Norton, who never ever showed any emotion, was in tears crying. What was going on? Mrs. Norton was crying? I couldn't believe it. That's when she announced the President had died and that school was canceled for the rest of the day.
Radio personality Doc Nelson.
I was 18 years old, been in the United States Army about 4 months, was stationed at Augusta, Georgia at Fort Gordon, where I was going to signal school when we heard the broadcast that President Kennedy had been assassinated. It's one of the few times I can remember in the service where everything absolutely came to a stop when we did basically nothing military. We sat in that classroom for the entire afternoon, not going out doing anything. And I think basically what affected me is I got mad. Being the fact that I was in the military and somebody did that to our president, you immediately want to retaliate. It will be with me all of my life because, again, I was at a young age. Now I understand a little bit better. But at that time, as an 18-year-old, they just can't do that to us. It will always be in my mind.
Radio personality
Dan Sheets.
Walking around and playing during recess at a noon hour time in North Queen Anne Grade School. A sunny day, playing with a bunch of kids. I was a 10-year-old kid at the time, and somebody just walked right up to me and says, "Hey, our president just got shot, and he's dead. He's died." Somehow the word had just gotten around to all the kids. Were just telling. I went and told another kid myself, and that was it. I was outside in recess hearing this horrible tragedy. So that's my remembrance of the assassination of our then-president, John Fitzgerald Kennedy.